Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Nightlight. I have a really super guest today. I'm so glad that that you all could join us, and I'm delighted that I get to pump her for more information, too. I have Sally Fryer Dietz with me today, and her book is Sensory Processing Solutions, Drug-Free Therapies to Realize Your Child's Potential. It's something that is very near and dear to my heart as well. And this book is enlightening, and no matter how old your child is, my child happens to be 51, and I now have begun to look back on his different steps and see if he fit into any of the categories and things that, you know, he seems to be just perfectly fine now, but you never know. So this book is a guide to help you find the right therapy program for your child. Every person, whether baby, child, teenager, or adult, interacts with the world in their own unique way. Yet some have a harder time than others due to a variety of sensory processing issues, which can lead to motor delays, learning differences, frustration, anxiety, emotional behavior, and social challenges, as well as a diagnosis like ADHD and autism spectrum. A sensory integration expert, Sally reveals these children are not broken. They're just a little bit different wired, that's all. Speaking from both her decades of professional experience as well as her own journey to help her oldest son, she shares in-depth guidance to help you find the right therapeutic support for your child, detailing common red flags at each developmental stage from infancy to grade school. She explains how children with sensory processing glitches are often misunderstood and put on medication rather than in therapies that can help them succeed naturally. Sharing how difficult it was to hear from her son's teachers that he was having more challenges in school than his peers, she presents success stories from her family and from her sensory integration therapy clinic. She outlines therapies and treatments for body and mind that can help improve your child's sensory motor development and function, such as sensory integration-based occupational, physical, and craniosacral therapy. My tongue is beginning to twist. No matter where your child is on the spectrum of sensory motor integration, this guide showcases effective solutions beyond medication and can help you figure out what options are available to help children grow into happy and productive adults. Sally is the founder and director of Integrative Pediatric Therapy and Integrative Concussion Therapy in Dallas, Texas. She lectures and teaches naturally and nationally and internationally on sensory integration, developmental therapy, craniosacral therapy, concussion rehabilitation, and the efficacy of combining traditional and alternative treatment methods. She's written two books, When Kids Fly, Solutions for Children with Sensory Integration Challenges, and the one we're talking about today, Sensory Processing Solutions, Drug-Free Therapies to Realize Your Child's Potential. It's an amazing book. No matter how old your children are, it's something good to take a look at and see if there have been signals all along the way. The only thing that, you know, if you happen to be a hypochondriac like I am, you could panic if you had one or two, if you didn't meet one or two of the limits of what, when something should be happening. But happily, my son survived me, and I'm hopeful that your children will survive you too. I think the most exciting thing about this book is it really looks at it doesn't look at something to do instead of medication, but it gives you lots of things that you can do to help your children evolve. And, you know, if meditation sometimes is something that you need to look into, but there are other options out there as well. So welcome to the show, Sally. I'm so glad you're here, and I'm so excited to share your material with my listeners.
Oh, well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It's, you know, I've looked for things like this all my life. I taught special ed, and I had a lot of kids that I swore were misdiagnosed and could easily have functioned in regular classrooms had they not been just suddenly labeled something. They throw titles at us all the time, and yet every child is so different. There isn't one category that any kid fits in totally.
Absolutely. So all of us are different. Yeah.
Yeah, happily. So what I know that your son being, even though he was very, very intelligent, was having some problems. And happily, you were in a field where you could look into things that could help him to function well so that he didn't need to be put in a special classroom.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My son, he's 38 years old now, but when he was 5, he was, you know, a super bright little guy. He knew all the names of every kind of, you know, fish in the fish book, and you know, he kind of beat to his own drum, and I just loved and appreciated him for every bit of it. And I as his mother didn't see any problems at all with him. I mean, everything that he did at home was, you know, fun and precocious, and he seemed to be right on track, you know, from just my experience. But his teacher, when he was at school, said he, you know, he didn't like to do things like he didn't want to learn how to write, and he really wasn't interested in doing the math kinds of things. He was at a Montessori school. And she suggested I take him to his pediatrician. And back in those days, teachers were a little bolder. They're not allowed to do this anymore. But she said, I think he might have attention deficit. And I was completely taken aback by it. But I did take him to his pediatrician. I was actually married to a physician as well at the time. And his pediatrician said, there's no, you know, exam, no nothing. He just said, well, why don't you try him on some Ritalin? And I was like, I was shocked. But at the same time, then my husband was saying, yeah, we should just try him and see, you know, what happens. This was, you know, a long time ago. But I had worked in San Francisco before I moved to Dallas, and I worked at a learning and development center. We saw lots of kids with attention deficit and lots of kids with any kind of developmental, you know, spectrum thing. And we did a treatment out there called sensory integration therapy. And I looked in Dallas for a place that could provide that kind of therapy, and there really was nobody. I don't know if it was fortunate or not, but at the time we did take the doctor's advice, tried him on Ritalin, and initially it seemed like, you know, he became certainly hyper-focused and did everything that his teachers wanted to do. It was almost like he was a little Stepford child in the classroom, but he was performing the way they wanted him to. And but very soon after that, you know, probably a month into it, I started getting concerned because he was so more withdrawn, very focused, but more withdrawn. The joy and the precociousness that I had seen, you know, just run off him so easily at home, it just wasn't there. And he would get more volatile at the end of the day. And there were just other things that were showing up as a result. And he really became depressed. And I took him to have a second opinion from a developmental pediatrician, and he confirmed my suspicions and said, you know, I think he's got depression. We need to give him a different pill that works on the other side of his neuroreceptors, so that, you know, that will help with his attention. And so they put him on that, and you know, finally I just thought, you know, and that's really why I opened my clinic, was for kids like him, because I wanted to find a place that would work with him and do sensory integration therapy, but there really was nothing at the time when he needed it. So I opened my clinic, but I could not be his therapist because I was his mom. So I hired another therapist to work with him, and I worked with other kids, and that's really where we started back in 1994. And I took him off his medicine, and he did great without the medicine, and he became very focused, and he was happy again. So that was the beginning of my journey as his mom and a therapist. And, you know, since then, we have truly treated thousands of children, and all with very similar results. I've never had a child who did not do better, because, you know, it really works on a very holistic level, no matter where you are on, you know, the spectrum of development. And, you know, all of us, you could say we're all just maybe a little bit autistic, or we're all just a little bit sensory glitched. It's just, where are you on that spectrum, you know, is how you interpret the world around you. And some kids just need a little bit more help getting started and being able to, you know, take in more of the world and making sense of it than others. And medication is not the only option for every single child. And I feel very strongly that we need to do everything we can in our power to help children, you know, before going down that road. I think that, yes, sometimes medication is warranted, but not if you haven't, you know, given other things a chance. I think every child's nervous system deserves the chance to develop on its own. And many times if we give it the right kind of input, you can see a huge difference. It really makes
Absolutely.
All the world
for,
a difference.
For those who are not familiar with the term sensory integration, can you sort of give a ballpark?
Yeah, sensory integration is something that all of us have to develop along those lines. When it comes to learning and development, though, there's three sensory systems that play a big piece in how you learn and develop. And that's the vestibular system, which is how you process movement, your coordination, you know, how you integrate both sides of the body, how your eyes and your hands work together. It also has a lot to do with your speech and language, the vestibular system. And then there's the proprioceptive system. That's how your joints and your muscles take in information. So if you're sitting in a chair and you close your eyes, it's your proprioceptive system that tells you that you're sitting in a chair. It gives you all the information around you. And you know, even you can get a sense of where you are in a room, or, you know, what things are, you know, happening around you. And then there's the tactile system, which is how you perceive touch. And that's both light and deep pressure touch, and it's both real and perceived touch around you. So those three sensory systems are always in play when it comes to learning and development. And when we talk about sensory integration, you know, we're talking about all the senses together, you know, how you see and how you hear and everything else, but we're really, you know, thinking of those three senses in particular when it comes to learning and development. So it's something that every single one of us has to make use of in order to grow and learn and put things together. And when we're, you know, sorting out, you know, problems or difficulties that a child might be having, we're going to look at those three systems and see what are the strengths and weaknesses and put together, you know, a better picture of, you know, what is making this child tick and, you know, what can we do to help support his or her nervous system to make the greatest sense of what's going on around him.
It just, you know, it I loved all the benchmarks, you know, from before birth to
you know,
birth and you know, and it was, yeah, you know, I can't remember back over 50 years. Well, I can remember back a lot of stuff, but not, you know, when did he talk, when did he walk, when did he do these things. And my son was full term, but he was born with the cord around his neck, so that he didn't start breathing for over 7 minutes. And being in special ed, I knew that, you know, deprivation to the brain was going to, you know, without oxygen was going to destroy stuff. And, you know, I was ready to find out, you know, where were his deficits and, you know, how could I supplement them early on? Couldn't find any, but they assured me that there had been some and that he might need some special help and stuff like that. So I started right away with playing with stuff with him and everything. He's fine, and he developed well and all of that. But, the title learning disability has always, always irked me because I think learning disability is really sensory integration that's gone wrong somehow. And it's not really that there's a disability there. It's just that they're wired differently.
Right.
And you have to figure out how they're wired.
Yeah, and I prefer to think of it as a learning challenge, maybe. It's not that these kids don't learn, and it has nothing to do with their intelligence, because so many of these kids are incredibly bright. It just, they have a hard time accessing that potential to be able to express it and communicate it to other people. Or they, you know, become very linear and are very show their precociousness in one area or another. So it's, you know, how many options we're able to give our kids and how we can help support normal, typical development in a way that really brings out the best and gives you the very most options.
Well, you mentioned one little boy that had trouble with nap time and in school, and I mean your solution, you observed him, you took a look at what was happening, you took a look at things that might have been in some way impeding his process, and I mean you came up with a program that the school was willing to implement, and it turns out that not only did it work better for him, it worked better for a lot of the kids.
Right.
So,
well, you know, I think so many times children do get pigeonholed, especially when they're causing any kind of disruption to a class. And it's very easy to just, you know, to wait until a child is melting down and having, you know, try to put out the fire after the fire has started. But really, if you can figure out what is going on for a child before they reach the point of melting down, that's really where your solution is. You want to set up the environment for them to be successful, not, okay, what do we do when they have a meltdown? And in this particular case, this little boy, there were a lot of things that contributed to his inability to not be able to take a nap in the classroom. But, you know, the parents were, you know, obviously vested in their child being successful in the classroom. And I find it always works better when everyone is on the same team. That means the teacher, the parents, the therapist, we're all working together, you know, for the sake of the child. And in this case, I was able to go and observe the classroom, see how he, you know, interacted with other kids during the school day. And also, where was he taking his nap? You know, what was going on? And what would happen is, and at home, he could nap fine without any kind of a problem. But at school, he had this little cot that was a little bit too hard for him. And, you know, this little lightweight blanket on top. And I think his bed was, you know, close to the door where there was all kinds of noise out in the hallway. And so he would lay down, and he had some vestibular dysfunction, which when he laid down, he sort of felt like he was floating around the room. And at home, he had heavy blankets, and, you know, he felt secure, and he had a bed that was, you know, smushy and kind of enveloped him like a beanbag, you know, kind of a chair, and he could nap and sleep just fine there. But in the classroom on this hard little cot, he was not getting the same messages, and it caused him to be more irritable and not be able to lay there, and so he would get up and you know, disrupt the whole class. So obviously nobody was happy in that classroom. But when we added some heavier blankets and some, you know, a little bit of cush underneath where he was sleeping, and we moved his cot away from the door where there was lots of noise out in the hallway, and we gave him a beanbag chair right next to the cot so that if and when he did wake up, he could, you know, sit in his, you know, this little comfy beanbag chair that gave him lots of proprioceptive support, and look at some books until, you know, his little classmates woke up. That worked great, and it worked immediately. I mean, it was really, it was a beautiful example of just with some creative problem solving and looking at and understanding the child too. So he'd already been in therapy. We knew about his vestibular dysfunction. We knew, you know, that proprioception can help to calm the body down and can ground the body so you don't feel like you're floating around. And we were able to, you know, really give some, you know, very simple solutions to a problem that in another school might not have turned out as well.
That is really one of the bigger issues that, you know, if teachers aren't willing to cooperate early on when there is greater flexibility in the classroom, you know, it makes it a lot easier to find and identify and then work with the issues that are at hand.
Right.
Because, Go ahead.
These poor teachers, you know, they really have a hard job. And it's very easy to become frustrated. And you can only imagine if you have a class, you know, especially a big class, you know, with, you know, more than, you know, 15 to 20 children in it, which is, you know, a lot more prevalent than we think. A small classroom these days is, you know, 12 to 15 kids. But it's hard to find that kind of a ratio anymore. But, you know, they're trying to, you know, teach to all these different levels and, you know, depending on the age of the child and what's going on, they know more than anybody if a child is kind of falling out of the typical range. Yet, you know, when a child does fall out of the typical range, sometimes they think there's something really wrong. And sometimes, you know, there are certainly bigger issues. But even with the kids who just kind of misbehave and aren't falling into the status quo of the classroom, you know, a teacher can become very frustrated and just have a hard time dealing with that kind of thing. But if you have access to a therapist physical therapist or an occupational therapist who can observe in the classroom, who works with the child, who understands child development and sensory integration. You know, the teacher can really get a lot of support and help in how to better manage that child so the child can be more successful in the classroom. Changing, you know, this child in one way or another, but just setting them up for success. And, you know, I find that a lot of times that, you know, that's one of the first steps is I do a lot of talks for teachers in schools, and, you know, we always give suggestions for things to try in the classroom and a perspective of how do you address vestibular and proprioceptive and tactile needs and that kind of thing in an appropriate way for all the kids that are in the class. And, you know, when those things don't work, that's when it's really a good idea to call in, a therapist to help, you know, more specifically problem solve. And, you know, kids who have underlying sensory integration deficits really, you know, do benefit from therapy in a therapeutic setting, which, you know, looks like a big playground. I mean, it's really, you know, using their bodies in different ways that they can be more successful and really building those sensory motor systems so that, you know, they can sit still in a chair more easily and they can, you know, focus and pay attention more easily and, you know, things fall into place a lot better for them. You know, in our educational system. Just how they take, you know, there's not as much, you know, physical education or music or things that involve movement. And so, you know, kids are more restless and they have a harder time being able to sit and focus when they can't get that kind of sensory input, even with just normal, typical development.
You mentioned, you know, a small trampoline, too. I mean, that's really easy to have something in the classroom where they can just get their energy out that way. And my degree is in any level of special ed and or up to ninth grade as far as in a regular classroom. And it seems to me that this kind of information is so important for teachers to be aware of and to understand their responsibility to, when I think over the years, kids that have been diagnosed special ed that in my opinion weren't really special ed, they were not Down syndrome, they were not Tourette's, they were not any of the major things that you think about, but that they just needed a little bit extra in some areas, and they would have been able to function in the regular classroom and therefore not labeled special ed, especially when you're coming to college and stuff like that. I mean, it to me is horrifying that so many of these kids are either misdiagnosed, medicated, or they just slip through the cracks and they give up on education. And
they get forced to do something.
That isn't right for them. I mean, the benchmarks that you give are fabulous. And, you know, now I wish I had kept a better baby book so I could kind of figure out, what was going on. He turned out okay, so I didn't screw him up too royally. I have a friend whose grandson, all he did was eat chicken McNuggets for 12, 13, 14 years. But he's turned out okay. He now eats a full range of foods and stuff like that. But, you know, his parents were very supportive, and they just gave him chicken McNuggets. And he came around, I guess. He was very supportive in lots of different ways as far as, you know, physical activities and stuff like that. But, I chuckled when I saw the chicken McNugget thing there. I said, I know somebody who has a grandson that's like that.
Yeah, well, you know, feeding can be a little tricky because there can be underlying issues with, it's very complicated to eat. And there's a lot of sensory systems that go on with eating, and there are a lot of muscles that are involved with eating. And so, you know, children who have a food preference of just, you know, one or two or three things, not only is that not good for your developing body, you know, you really need to get a wide variety of vitamins in there, but there can be a mechanical issue that could be addressed, you know, with the right kind of assessment. You know, it takes somebody who's really trained to look at what is really going on. It's very rarely a behavioral thing. It's usually a physical thing. And how, you know, they're perceiving, you know, what's in their mouth. You know, does their tongue work, you know, well enough to get mobilize the food in the mouth to get it to the back of the tongue to be able to swallow it? And does your, you know, esophagus and your trachea work together so that you don't choke when that food goes down? And, you know, all the different sensations that go with that. And some kids can have a really hard time, especially, you know, we look back at the history of the child, you know, premature babies who've been tube fed, you know, can have some emotional stuff that's tied in with their sucking and swallowing. You know, kids who were, you know, spoon-fed everything, who didn't experiment with food when they were, you know, being weaned and starting to eat more solid foods when they're about 6 months. You know, if somebody's always putting, you know, spooning food into their mouth, it can, you know, cause a kind of a physical, emotional backlash. And there's ways to deal with that in, you know, certain, you know, feeding approaches. We use a SOS approach that's more of a sequential sensory feeding approach, and where kids change their relationship with food and eating and experimenting with different smells and textures and tastes and stuff so that they, you know, they can get the nutrition that they really need to grow and develop, you know, in the most healthy way.
Well, now, this program, what about working with autistic children? Does that apply with autism as well?
Well, so, you know, when we talk about sensory integration, we're looking at a spectrum of development. And if you, you know, just can imagine in your mind's eye, a spectrum where on one end of the spectrum you have your severely autistic kids. And then as you move up that spectrum, you get into the typical range where kids are able to process sensory motor information appropriately. And you keep moving up that range and you get into the gifted range. It's the same spectrum of sensory motor development, but your children who are autistic and some of your kids who are exceptionally gifted actually can have behaviors that look very similar. But we look at that range of how they process sensory motor information and take that information in. So, you know, when I said earlier, you know, we're all probably just a little bit autistic, I really wasn't kidding because we all have different sensory glitches. It just is, how many do you have? So with autism, we utilize the same approach, that sensory motor approach, and really, you know, helping kids to take in their environment in a more appropriate way. Autism is a very, you have a very limited sensory perception where you might only focus in on one or two things, and it's very easy to tune out the world because it's overwhelming in a big sensory way. So if we could open up their world a little bit more in a way that makes it safer for them to be in, you decrease the anxiety in the body and you get more of an ability to, you know, to relate to others and to, you know, try new things and taking the world in a little bit bigger way.
Now, if you're working with somebody who has autism, that's really almost a lifetime of you know, going back and getting a checkup and, you know, a little bit of extra help here and there, as opposed to somebody who's just got the other glitches that, you know, up through high school, you know, you may, you I know you said at one point that really having any form of this kind of therapy, you have to look at it for at least 6 months to fully see if something is really integrated appropriately.
Right.
But
what happens is the earlier you can identify issues and the earlier you can get help, the greater opportunity for the most change. We're able to change, you know, we've got neuroplasticity that lasts throughout our entire lifetime. So, you know, a lot of the things that we see with children, we can also apply to adults even later. Or this is where if you have a concussion, it throws you back into a sensory integration glitch and that kind of thing. But with a developing nervous system, if you start seeing red flags early on, say even in the first year or two of life where a child doesn't establish eye contact, you know, seems to be delayed in speech and language and seems to not really connect to others, you want to jump on that as early as you possibly can because you can make a much bigger difference. We've had children who were diagnosed with autism who after, you know, not just 6 months of therapy, but after several years of therapy, ended up not having a diagnosis of autism after all. And, you know, yes, they did have pretty significant sensory integration, you know, glitches or problems that were getting in the way, but with the right kind of input, they were able to really move up that spectrum so that they were able to take in more of the world and perform at a much higher level, which gave them more opportunities. It doesn't mean that everybody with autism is going to, you know, end up in the typical range, but it gives everyone the opportunity to do better than they would otherwise. So, you know, really understanding early on what's going on is a gift.
Well, it also gives them tools to fall back on as well.
Correct, yeah.
So
and
that,
even, you know,
the,
kids...
What?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, even children, you know, who have a diagnosis with attention deficit, and when we're looking at the sensory, you know, sensory processing, a lot of times those kids have trouble with some bilateral coordination or how their bodies work, and they might not be particularly athletic. Well, in an adult, the way you manage attention deficit is through exercise. So if you're not very coordinated and you never get that treated when you're a kid, you know, to the way that you can use your body more effectively, then you're not as likely to exercise as an adult, which is one of the things that can help to manage it. But if when you're a child, you do get the right kind of help, you get your body to be stronger and more coordinated, and you develop a different relationship with exercise and activities and sports and things like that, then you're more likely to carry on that habit throughout life in a way that helps to support your nervous system so that you can, again, you know, have things not be as hard as they would otherwise.
What about stroke victims who lose the capacity to speak and stuff like that? Because you're working with the brain and the brain can be rewired and some of this therapy is actually the metronome part of it is rewiring and educating. What about stroke victims or people who wake up from comas and need to be reintegrated into the totality of what a physical environment is?
Well, actually, it absolutely applies. It's why we started integrative concussion therapy, because we started seeing when people would have concussions, which is a head injury. It's different than a stroke, but it's still an injury to the brain. They would have the same kinds of sensory motor problems that our kids with developmental disabilities have. They would have, you know, trouble with their balance. They'd have trouble with, you know, their thinking. They'd have kind of foggy thinking. They might have headaches or visual functional vision problems. Those are all things that, you know, we end up, you know, treating through a sensory integration approach. And so when you address those issues, you can, and you address them completely, you can have a complete recovery from a concussion. But more often than not, people kind of muscle through it, and they either do too much or they do too little. And if you have a history or an underlying history of learning differences or sensory motor problems, you're more apt to have a prolonged recovery from a concussion. And, you know, a lot of times kids and adults, people in general, don't even realize they're having sequelae from a concussion even months after the injury, when they are, their grades drop in school or, you know, other problems begin to happen. And it's because, you know, the body hasn't, the brain hasn't been, you know, rewired in the way that helps to support the nervous system for their learning and development going forward. So there's a lot of overlap. You know, your nervous system, the way your brain and your central nervous system and your peripheral nervous system work, it's a very complex, you know, system. And it works by making neural connections and supporting, you know, the chemistry in the brain. And when things get mixed up or you have an injury to it, brain has the potential to rewire itself, but you have to get the information in there to create that wiring. So if you don't have any input into it, it's really hard to make a neural connection to connect it to the pieces that have the action to it. That's a very simplified version of the nervous system and how it works, but it really is, you know, what's fired together is wired together. And you know, it's how all these therapies work, whether it's an interactive metronome or sensory integration or developmental therapy or functional vision, you're providing the body with opportunities to create those neural connections and really, you know, build on those to have the support that you need to perform well. You know, obviously,
so,
if you
so
have
that,
a...
You know,
sorry,
yeah,
I keep interrupting.
I keep interrupting you. So even in cases like dementia, where you know, certain parts of your brain just go to sleep, with this kind of therapy, I'm not saying it's a cure. I'm not saying it'll stop a process. But it seems to me that you can be more functional utilizing a lot of these modalities in keeping and helping your brain to rewire where some of your wires may have gotten crossed.
Right. Well, even with healthy aging, if you look at the things that help keep a brain active, you know, preventing processes like dementia, the things that help are activities that stimulate the brain in new ways. Anything, you know, you read all the brain research today, and it talks about, you know, maintaining friendships, having conversations with other people, learning a new skill, you know, taking a dance class, you know, listening to music, you know, going for walks, exercising your body to get oxygen to your brain. Those are all just typical activities that help to support brain health. When we talk about therapy, that's a very focused opportunity to support brain health. So, you know, you've got professionals who are really looking after your nervous system and providing you with opportunities and ways to make those connections. And, you know, some people really need, especially in with aging, somebody to kind of guide them through that process. I know even for myself, uh-huh. If I go to the gym, I am fully capable of doing my own exercise program. I'm a doctor of physical therapy. I know all about exercise, and I help people all the time with it. But I really like going to the gym and having a trainer who tells me what to do because I don't want to have to think about it. And I help to support my body that way. So we all have, different preferences, especially as adults. We have the opportunity to set our lives up in ways that can help to enhance our aging, process so that we don't decline faster than we need to. We're all going to get older, and there's, we all need to do things to keep our brains and our bodies alive. So whether it's through therapy or through just active, healthy living or a combination of both, it's worth knowing about. And there are things that you can do and people and places you can go to get the support that you need to help, especially if you feel like you're having a bigger problem than you should be in those areas.
Well, as we get older, we, all of us start to panic. Like, it's, I'm 60, I'm 70, I'm 80, I'm 90, I'm 100. Now, maybe at 100 I won't panic. But you never know, because there are people that go to 125. So it's a matter of challenging yourself, I think, is the best way to put it.
Absolutely. And for kids, for children, we're working with children who have not had the opportunity to even develop those things in the first place. And that's uh-huh. where, adults and teachers and doctors and anybody having anything to do with a child's development really plays a big part. Because it's not like they can say, I want to go do this or I want to do that. They don't know what that is yet. And we're the ones who are uh-huh. saying, okay, let's get you in this, let's try a martial art class, or let's, try swimming, or let's, try some of these other things that also help to support the nervous system and the integration of the brain and the body. And, if a child is struggling and having trouble with that, going beyond the pill to see, okay, what else can we do? And, having the right professional really weigh in on going on with your child can make, such a big difference in guiding you to the kinds of therapies and activities that, really can be beneficial to them.
Well, society, with today's society, it takes two parents working just about all the time in order
right.
to keep a family moving. And yet there are things that you can do as a family group that definitely, we talked, briefly before the show, doing crossword puzzles is a phenomenal exercise, and yet it's something the entire family can do. And
right.
It's putting pieces together and making connections, and oftentimes we rely too much, I believe, on AI. While I love the games there.
I know. It's getting to be even, it's getting to be, it is really a big problem. It's a big problem for children who are growing and developing. It's a big problem for adults and for all of us when we're relying on programs and other things to keep, to do the jobs that we should be able to do ourselves, like even remembering your friends' phone numbers. We used to do that all the time because we didn't have a phone that we carried around with us that had everybody's number registered in it. Some people have a hard time remembering their own phone number, you know, because they're not using it. And that's your working memory. That's what you need to be able to sustain a conversation. It's what you need to be able to, you know, be creative and process information and make intelligent decisions. And, you know, if we're not thinking for ourselves and we're not using our brains in the way they really are designed to be used, you know, you use it or you lose it. And it's really true when it comes to brain health. You need to be able to use your brain in a way that, you know, keeps these connections growing, not atrophying. Yeah.
You know, there are certain games that I don't do the Sudoku thing, but I do other games. And, you know, I think that as we get older, every now and then, I know that I've been on the computer doing a radio show and a website for 15, 16 years. But every now and then I will say to my tech, you know, well, teach me how to do this because I don't want to bother you and I don't want to pay you. So teach me how to do this so that I can do this particular thing. And I'm constantly, you know, saying, teach me how to do this. And, you know, when I screw it up, you can fix it, but teach me how to do it. And I think the when somebody says it's too hard, you can't do it, that's when I know I have to do it because, you know, and there are some things that, you know, are just beyond me at this point in time. But for the most part, it's learning something new all the time, doing something new. If I've been there and I've done that, I don't want to do it again. I'll try something else. So far, it's stood me in great stead, and you know, and I think a lot of people when they get, you know, when they retire and everything, they kind of turn everything off, and that's the time when you're supposed to be turning things on.
Right. Well, but you know, you look at the brain research, and it's very important. You know, the whole idea of retiring isn't to just go sit in a chair, you know, and look at the TV. Although, you know, lots of the sitcoms and everything, that's what you would think. But, you know, you can tell when somebody has retired and has just kind of rebranded their life. Like, it's an opportunity to try something new. Maybe you're not going to the office every day in the way that you have for the last 40 years, but we're going to do something new. And you volunteer or you go get involved in your favorite, you know, charity, or you try something new. You get, you know, even helping out with your grandkids can be a new learning opportunity. You know, I mean, there are lots of different ways to use your brain beyond just being passive. And, you know, some people may choose to do that, and other people, you know, want to stay more vibrant. And it just, if you're one of those people that wants to stay more vibrant, then you got to embrace a more vibrant life. And, you know, learning new things, trying new things, you know, playing games like you suggested, you know, having, you know, taking a class, going to, there's, you know, great community outreach, you know, programs in different colleges where there's, you know, classes, both intellectual and art and music and, you know, doing some of those things, just like for our kids, like what we do with our kids.
Yeah, and, you know, like learning bridge. I mean, bridge is a mental game more than anything else, I think. I have tried it a number of times and found that it did not like me. But I can see how bridge and chess, two amazing games that can take a lifetime to master and keep your brain functional. And so yeah, write a book. There's a wonderful program out there called oh gosh, what's it called? It's a story. They send you a question every week about your life, and you write the answer, and it's called Word Something. You write the answer and send it back to them, and you can put pictures with your answers, and it's, you know, talking about your life and things that happened in your life. And at the end of a year's time, they put it all together and they bind it into a book.
How neat.
And my daughter-in-law gave it to me as a gift one Mother's Day. And for that year, I cursed her, and I, on the other hand, thought this is a wonderful thing. I'm learning about my past that I never had realized. Like, what was your favorite show as a young child? Well, we didn't have TV when I was a young child. but you know, it early on, and it was just, it's Story Worth is the name of the program. And,
well, that's neat.
And it was just such an education for me. I would be willing to do it again, maybe. But it was such a joy to go into some of those questions, and some of the ones that I thought were stupid turned out to be the most interesting to me, because I was going back and reflecting as an adult on something that happened as a child. So that was a wonderful thing for my daughter-in-law to give me, and now that it's all done and I have a book in my hand that's 400 pages long with family pictures in and all sorts of stuff, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. So it's a great gift for your grandchildren, because, you know, they're never going to ask you all those questions. And when you pass over, they're going to wonder about a lot, and it's all there in the book.
Oh, I love that. I think that's a great idea. That's neat.
It was definitely an adventure. And, you know, when I fell behind by 3 or 4 questions, I did a lot of cursing. But it was absolutely worthwhile doing. It really was. But something like that is a lot of fun. And you know, you send it off, and they bind it, and you get a beautiful project out of it. It's a delight to do.
Yeah,
just by the way, I just noticed our time is up.
I know. Time flies when you're having fun.
It does. That's why I do podcasts. So where do people go to find out about you and your work and your books and everything else, and get a hold of you if they want to?
Sure. So I'm in Dallas, Texas. I have a large multidisciplinary practice. We have physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech therapists who all are specialized in child development, developmental pediatrics, and sensory integration. Our website is IPT, for Integrative Pediatric Therapy, kids, KIDS.com. I also have a website for Sally Fryer Dietz. That's www.sallyfryerdietz.com, that has, you know, all the different kinds of things that we do, or I do. We also have a website on concussions, concussion-therapy.com, if you're more interested in concussion and brain health and what we can do for concussions. But we're here in Dallas. I have, you know, 2 books are on Amazon, Sensory Processing Solutions, and When Kids Fly, and you just Google my name and you'll see it pop up. But I'm passionate about doing this and helping children and setting kids up for success, and so I wish you all the happiest of journeys in that. But there are resources out there and worth checking into for sure.
Absolutely, and especially, you know, as an adult as well, if you're just retiring and you're feeling like you're sinking into oblivion, a lot of this stuff is an easy way to kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and get onto another phase of life that can be even more challenging and more fun because you don't have to work.
That's right. Absolutely. I so agree. So... Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
it was a delight, and thank you. And I will be in touch because I have lots more questions, but I will be in touch.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, Barbara.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be here again tomorrow night and again on Wednesday night. Big treat for you to be here this often, this week anyhow. So watch for us. Check out the website, barbaradelong.com. Calendar there will tell you when and where. And I look forward to seeing and hearing from you. Thanks a lot, everybody.